From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Yeah, our connection this hour was made in a neighborhood. And if you recognize this music, you know it's Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, of course. On this particular day, a very warm one, Mr. Rogers is sitting out on his lawn, cooling his feet in a plastic swimming pool. His friend, Officer Clemens, stops by for a visit, and Mr. Rogers welcomes the officer to join him in the pool. On the surface, maybe it doesn't seem significant to share space in a plastic swimming pool, but in racially segregated 1969, when Jim Crow laws made many pools off-limits to African-Americans, that gesture from Mr. Rogers was momentous. Officer Clemens is black, and the racist narrative at the time in certain parts of the country was that African-Americans carry disease that could be spread in places like swimming pools. Well, in this episode, Fred Rogers was using public television to make a statement. It was just one example of how he used his program and his medium to demonstrate what he thought the world should be, a place where all people are treated equally, where feelings can be discussed, and in his words, where everyone is special just the way they are. His story is told in the documentary Won't You Be My Neighbor, which has become a surprise box office hit this summer. That film, along with the documentary RBG about Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, highlight soft voices with powerful messages in a turbulent time. Theater owners and critics say Ginsburg and Rogers appeal to people of all backgrounds and have the power to heal divides in a polarized country. Well, this hour we discuss the impact that Rogers and Ginsburg have had on generations of people, including maybe those of you listening, and our guests in studio. And by the way, you can see Won't You Be My Neighbor at the Little Theater through Thursday, I think, at least. So there you go. The Little, I saw it last night at the Little, and so you still have a few chances. So get out and see it. Elisa Orlando has seen it. She's the Senior Vice President of Television and News for WXXI. Nice to see you back in here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Paula LaRue Wooters, who's a teacher in the Rochester City School District's Universal Pre-K program at Asbury Daycare Center. Paula, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And welcome back to Beth Cordello, chair of the employment law practice at Polano and Faro, inspired by the notorious RBG.
Yes, indeed.
You told me that the only reason you haven't seen that film yet is you're waiting for a time where you can take your two daughters?
Correct.
So what do you want them to see and maybe experience with not just a film like that with RBG, but why it's impacted you, why her career has impacted you?
Well, I've talked to them about how she's inspired me. One of her major decisions in the late 90s where women, as a result of that decision, women were allowed to enroll at the Virginia Military Institute that was previously an all-male public college that coincided at a time when I was in the military. And I was excluded from positions in the military because at that time, women could not be in certain occupations within the military. In fact, women haven't been fully integrated in the military until 2016. Now women can apply for any job. So I read that decision with great interest at the time, and of course, ultimately left my position as a medic in the Army National Guard and then enrolled in law school.
Wow. Yeah. So there you go. So there's some of the fruit of RBG's work there. And we say that with affection. That's the name of the film, RBG. We've got clips we'll share later. And of course, the Fred Rogers documentary is on the heels of a PBS television special on Fred Rogers, which you saw earlier this year. And Elisa Orlando, I watched last night, and I really did think it's a shame he can't live forever, because in every political moment, it always feels like now is the most vitriolic, but it always feels like now is the time we need more Fred Rogers.
It certainly seems that way, and that's being written about quite a bit, many opinion pieces. There's a piece in the New York Times, there's a piece in the Atlantic, there are pieces being written about Fred all over the place right now. What I think is interesting, seeing the movie and being in the Little Theater quite often, is that there are many young people going to see the documentary because they remember the TV show. Also, people are crying with abandon during that film. I think in some cases it's a case of nostalgia, but I also think what you're saying, this idea that the sort of radical kindness that we don't experience every day, I think is really having an effect on people. It certainly had an effect on me and my family.
There was that moment in the film, that radical kindness, where Fred Rogers is being interviewed, and the interviewer is asking him essentially two questions. are you really this nice? Are you really this guy? And by the way, are you gay? And you know, that, he's asking them because right. people had went through stereotypes. They went through. They couldn't get their head around. And by the way, to state the obvious, there's plenty of really nice and not so nice gay people. I mean, so that, but the way people would conflate, they just couldn't make out. Could Fred Rogers really be this guy?
And there's no piece of writing that I've been able to find where the writer hasn't been turned to that way of thinking that, no, this is really him. This is not an act. And in every case of writing I've been reading, the writer is moved in some way. There's a piece in Esquire that recently was republished. It was written in 1998, where the writer actually, at the very end of the article, prays with Fred Rogers. Fred Rogers was a minister. And he talks about how his entire time with Fred Rogers, he feels, was created by Mr. Rogers so that he would pray with him one day. And it's Esquire magazine, so it's a very interesting piece of journalism, but also he was just completely authentic, and I can't find anyone who disputes that notion who's written about him. And certainly those of us that knew of him and watched his show felt that way.
He had this disarming way of allowing, whether it was a child or an adult, to feel like they could open up and talk about their feelings. And I think that was perhaps part of the stereotyping of Fred Rogers, because certainly even now, you know, all the stereotypes about men don't talk about feelings. And, but boy, did he take that apart and did that in ways where at first you would go, is this going to work? You know, you pull the puppet out, the Daniel mm-hmm. Tiger puppet, which I had forgotten how dingy that little puppet was.
I know.
Not very low tech.
I know.
It was very low tech. But it worked. And I had also forgotten, Elisa, that he tried to do some adult specials as well. Which I would go. I would love to go back and see. WXXI should put those on the air.
I know. I wish we could. I wish we could find them and see them. He's really not very well known for that at all. He had a children's show before Mr. Rogers that was not. He was not the star of that show. It wasn't until he went full on as a host for children that he really began to make connections with children, probably more so than adults at that point.
Mm. Paula, as someone who teaches in the Universal Pre-K program, I imagine some of those lessons on just the way we communicate with kids and the way we encourage them to open up stays with them.
Absolutely. And the whole idea of being authentic with children is so critical as a teacher. One of the big things we do in UPK is we do a lot of problem solving. And it always starts with, what are your feelings? And acknowledging how the child's feeling. And that's what's so powerful with Mr. Rogers, is he could just sit there and look at you and listen. The whole idea of listening is really key too, not just trying to take over and tell the child what feelings they might be feeling, but taking the time to listen to find out what's really going on with this child.
They also tackled themes in that show that I was frankly at times watching the documentary last night going, they talked about assassination, they talked about the Vietnam War. Let's listen to this clip of this is on the heels of the RFK assassination. Well, of course, the nation is talking about it. And so Fred Rogers, you hear him explain in the film that he did not want to avoid a subject that he knew that kids would be hearing about. And he used Daniel Tiger along with Miss Lane. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Having this conversation. So this was... let's go ahead and listen now, and we'll talk about it.
What does assassination mean?
Have you heard that word a lot today?
Yes. And I didn't know what it meant.
Well, it means somebody getting killed in a sort of surprise way.
Boy, I mean, is this what it is? With kids, there are times where parents, I think about it all the time myself. Can we talk about this? What do you make of that?
Yeah, there's really nothing that's taboo in our classroom. The things that are important to children are the things we talk about. And when you think about it, the children that we serve in the city school district, a lot of them have faced death very close to them. And so these are very, it's very raw for many of them. And to be able to have that outlet where it's safe to talk about things is just really, it's a gift to the children to give that to them. And it makes them feel safe to be able to talk about it and to know that their classroom is a safe place to do that. And I think that's what Mr. Rogers embodies, is that everybody needs that safe space with a safe person to talk about and say, what does this really mean? This is scary to me.
Beth, as a parent yourself, how many times have you asked yourself, boy, can I talk about this with kids? And then sometimes the kids will disarm you and they'll bring something up themselves at the age of 4, 5, 6 years old.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in the context of our times, I think about the school shootings we see in the news all the time. And, you know, my older daughter has an iPod Touch that has news updates, you know, so she sees these things, or you turn on the television and there's the news. And as much as you don't want to talk about it with your kids because you want to protect them, yet you have to. You have to find a way to do it.
Fred Rogers retired in 2001. They kind of called him back to at least make a short presentation after 9/11. And he was on the air when Columbine happened, but certainly he was not on the air when the rash of school shootings, like Beth brings up, has become almost feeling like a weekly or monthly numb part of American life. And I do wonder what he would have done with that. But surely we know he would have addressed that, don't you think, Elisa?
He would have addressed it. I think public television would have addressed it and does address it. His company now with Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood addresses some of those themes. But, you know, if you remember the song, What Do You Do With the Mad That You Feel, was a popular song on his program. He used it more than once. And when I think about things like school violence, that's what I think about, is what if these young people had heard that song when they were a young person and understood better how to deal with the feelings that they had.
Now, I need you to give me a little history lesson here, okay? Because the film has a history lesson that is really relevant to us in public broadcasting today. And that is at, in the 60s, the hearings regarding public broadcasting funding. What I want to know is, did the film take any liberties here? Because the narrative that the film gives you is that you've got this Senator Grumpy was his name. I don't remember his actual name.
Right.
And he was just not really, he didn't seem to have the door open for the $20 million for public broadcast funding. And they'd heard this testimony, and he's sort of rolling his eyes. And then Fred Rogers comes in, and Fred Rogers is nervous. And by the time Fred Rogers is done, the guy's like, well, you got your $20
million. Right.
I mean,
right.
It really
it's
did happen that way.
About. It really did. Well, you can see it. There's footage of it. You can watch the testimony. And I believe the way the documentary portrays it, when they made the PBS show about Fred Rogers, they did not really deal with it at all, which makes me believe that, in fact, it probably was true, because I don't think PBS would want to do anything that was particularly self-serving in a film like that. But yeah, to watch the footage is pretty, I think we are, in some ways, I felt like I'm so jaded in this day and age, a little cynical, that I can't believe that he might have actually had that effect on somebody. But I believe it.
Well, and we've got a clip from it. And the name wasn't Senator Grumpy, by the way. It was Senator John Pastore, who was the senator from Rhode Island, who led the hearing. He had never, says he had never seen or heard Fred Rogers' television show. Fred Rogers took him about 6 minutes to get him to flip on his position. Let's listen to part of that.
I feel that if we in public television can only make it clear that feelings are mentionable and manageable, we will have done a great service for mental health. Could I tell you the words of one of the songs which I feel is very important?
Yes.
This has to do with that good feeling of control, which I feel that the children need to know is there. And it starts out, what do you do with the mad that you feel? And that first line came straight from a child. I work with children, doing puppets in very personal communication with small groups. What do you do with the mad that you feel when you feel so mad you could bite? When the whole wide world seems oh so wrong, and nothing you do seems very right. It's great to be able to stop when you've planned a thing that's wrong, and be able to do something else instead, and think this song. I can stop when I want to, can stop when I wish, can stop, 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 anytime. And what a good feeling to feel like this. and know that the feeling is really mine, know that there's something deep inside that helps us become what we can.
I think it's wonderful.
Looks like you just earned the $20 million.
See, that's what I thought. I mean, like, but it really happened that way, didn't it?
From what I've seen, yes, it did.
Which is why Elisa Orlando and many others at WXXI will occasionally post that clip to remind everyone decades later that we feel exactly the same about the value of public media, and we miss Fred Rogers, but that message endures. And Paula, I love the words of that song. How do you feel like it relates to kids these days?
Oh, absolutely. Again, because your feelings are where everything stems from, and you need to know how to use those and accept those, and how do you react to them? How do you get them out in a safe way? And again, the whole idea that all of us can learn how to do that, whether you're a child or an adult. If you can learn this as a child, how powerful is that to you as you go forward into adulthood, to be able to manage things, and which many of us fail at that often.
There were moments in the film where Fred Rogers had little flashes of even a little anger, his frustration with television as a medium failing children, not just over stimulating, but the violence, the thoughtlessness, the lack of, in his words, human dignity of the child that he would experience. How much do you think, and this is not meant to be a softball to you because you're the VP of news and television here at XXI, but I think this is, I was really thinking about that last night. I mean, I've got a six-year-old, and it's amazing how ubiquitous junk television is, even now. And it's hard to navigate that. How much do you think that is still central to public broadcasting, Elisa?
Well, it's definitely central to public broadcasting. I mean, central to the public broadcasting service is a mission of education. So a lot of what you see on public television now has to do with educational themes. Sesame Street's a perfect example. Other kinds of programs that we have had on over the years. If you're old enough to remember Wishbone, you'll remember that he taught us literature with the little dog. Reading Rainbow, which taught us how to read. There are lots of education that's going on, especially for young children, on public television. And it's all taught with a lot of gentility. It's a quieter sense of media, I think. But I don't see anything doing what Fred Rogers was doing on public television specifically, which is just to say to the children, you have worth, inherent worth of kids. And I have heard criticism of Fred Rogers that he was telling every child they're special and you shouldn't do that.
Yep.
Right,
that
in the film.
Doc, yep.
Right. But I mean, to me anyway, it was more just that he loved children and he felt they were worthy. He didn't just treat them with a lot of dignity. I feel in reading about him and watching the documentary that he felt they had more dignity than adults. He loved children. He felt they were probably more important than adults, and treated them that way. So that, I don't think, is going on in media anywhere right now, perhaps. I don't know if I could say that's going on anywhere.
Is there good television? Isn't it so hard to find for parents right now, for kids?
So hard to
find. I feel like such a fuddy-duddy when I say that, but it's really true. It's hard.
It's true.
Do you police it? I mean, do you find yourself asking them, what are you guys watching? What are you doing?
Yes, but you can only control it so much, as I'm sure you'll find out. I mean, you can control, obviously, how much television they watch, but there is so little good content out there.
And they'll go to a friend's house. You know, they're not always with you.
Correct.
There's some positive television. Paw Patrol is a positive show, pretty much.
Yeah.
Octonauts, which is a BBC series.
I lived
about
Paw
Marine.
Patrol for about
you
2 years.
You did? Okay,
yeah.
Sure you did.
We phased out of that, yep.
Octonauts is a BBC series,
yeah, pretty
which
good.
Is about marine exploration.
Yep.
It's not bad.
Right.
It's not bad stuff. But in terms of what Fred was doing, which is just to spend some time, let's be quiet, and understand the world around us, I don't think that's going on anywhere.
Yeah. How do you feel about what kids are exposed to?
What's really frightening to me is when I see children who don't know how to play, children whose everything is a scenario to them, and they're reenacting things they've seen on television. So when we go into the imaginative play at school, they don't know how to come up with their own themes. Many of them don't. And they just repeat things they've heard before. They'll say, oh, well, this is what you have to say because that's how they said it on TV. And to me, that it's very sad when you see that. And the whole in the documentary where they showed the village, and he said, "Well, it's very rough looking, and it doesn't look perfect." And that's the whole idea, is to use your imagination. Where do you go from there? And I think a lot of the television that the kids watch, the imagination isn't there. It doesn't stimulate that. And that's what Mr. Rogers did, was he really stimulated their thinking and their creation of ideas, which was really critical.
Yeah, that was the moment of the documentary that another of the moments that caught me by surprise. I did not recall the frustration Fred Rogers felt when there was the story of a child who jumped off a building trying to be Superman, mm-hmm. not realizing, you know, that's all make-believe here. And he was upset with the failure of television to help kids understand the difference and to cultivate imagination. So now when my son watches Daniel Tiger, there's a part of every Daniel Tiger episode now where he says, "Do you want to make believe with me?" You know, in the same way that on the program in Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, there was Make Believe World, where Fred Rogers himself didn't exist. He did the voices, but it was clear to kids that it was imagination. But he had that frustration that, why is there so much media and yet kids are struggling to play, to right. imagine, to understand the distinctions, mm-hmm. similar to what you're seeing?
Absolutely. And even things like coming up with an idea of what do you need for your play?
Yeah.
What do you want to use for that? And they want to have the specific things they've seen on TV. This whole idea of inventing something to put into your play is lost, and that's the other sad part about it. So how can we bring all that back in? And that's what we try to do in our classroom.
Elisa also brought up a part toward the end of the documentary where, sorry if we're giving everything away, but you just have to go see the documentary. You're going to have to do it. And I don't care if we're giving it away, because you're still going to go and you're still going to cry. And it's showing at the Little Theater through Thursday. So it's a great chance to see Won't You Be My Neighbor. That section at the end where the controversy of Fred Rogers, did Fred Rogers help raise a generation of kids who think they're all special and they're all entitled and they don't have to work and they don't have to earn being special? You know, there's a clip, and I don't mean to make this political, there is a clip from a Fox News anchor, Brian Kilmeade, saying, you know, Fred Rogers, and he's angry in this clip, it's very strange. Fred Rogers is the reason all these kids think they're special. Well, they're not special, you got to earn it. I thought the documentary did a masterful job then, turning it back to Fred Rogers, saying he explained what he meant by that. And he was at a commencement mm-hmm. ceremony where he said, "What I mean is, you don't have to earn someone's love. You are deserving of love who you are. Whatever you look like, you're worthy of love. Whatever you sound like, you're worthy of love. Who you are is worthy of being loved. That's it. Not that you're special and you don't have to work at it." And I don't know why we twist that message.
Well, we're a success-driven culture. We're an achievement-driven culture, I think, right now in America. So I think it's just not a message you can understand. I certainly did not take this program very seriously when I was a young adult or a middle-aged adult. You know, it's sort of, I think right now it is actually, you know, standing in stark relief to what's happening in the world right now. So I think that's part of the reason why we're talking about it. But I think our culture believes in achievement, and he wasn't talking about achievement. He was just talking about worth.
Let me read a couple of listener comments, and I will let our listeners know, if you've seen the documentaries, we're going to talk a little bit more about RBG in our second half hour, but we're talking about Won't You Be My Neighbor?, the documentary about Fred Rogers, which is showing at the Little Theater through Thursday. You can also catch it this weekend at various places around town, I'm told. But I only really know what's going on at the Little. Also, we're talking about RBG, the documentary about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And if you've seen them and you want to weigh in, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Kara writes to the program and says, "I think we're at a point where we need film to be more than a form of escape from the world through fiction, fantasy, etc. In these two films especially, we need it as a reminder of the incredible capacity for good and positive change that real people have." That's from Kara. It's true. I mean, Fred Rogers is amazing. And that was one real guy, as we've been talking about. That was who he was on screen and off. Jane says, I saw the documentary. It was beautifully done, and all of us in the theater cried. He was the personification of goodness, compassion, and love. I always knew he was a good man, but I didn't know some of the depth to him, that he had a lonely childhood due to illness and being bullied for being overweight. Yeah, that's right, Jane. And there's a point in the film where I think one of his children, Fred Rogers' children, is weighing in saying, if he hadn't been an overweight child, he might not have become, there might not have been a Mr. Rogers neighborhood. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. And the bullying themes there. There's a ton of listener feedback. We'll get to more of it in our second half hour. I also want to read a little bit of what Jeff Spivak wrote, who occasionally contributes here at WXXI, and we're always glad to have Jeff's work here. But Jeff wrote for his own website. He says, quote, how could anyone doubt Fred Rogers' message of respect? And yet, doubters there were. Won't You Be My Neighbor takes a moment to show a few newspaper columns by conservative writers and a Fox News host, his voice spiraling upward in outrage, castigating Rogers for his belief that everyone was special. No, the conservatives howl, everyone is not special, you must earn special. Well, Rogers levels his critics. Treating others with dignity isn't a reward to be handed out, like a biscuit for a good dog. Let's make goodness attractive in this so-called new millennium, he says. And Jeff concludes his piece by saying, there were many people weeping in the theater during Won't You Be My Neighbor? And afterwards, as the lights went up, was it a sentimental trip down memory lane? Perhaps for some, but mostly in the pure light cast by Fred Rogers and his belief in the goodness of humanity, we're all left to wonder, why are we living today in such shadows? That's from Jeff. What do you make of that, Paula?
Well, I really think that the whole concept of just like Fred Rogers, I'm taking my time here. just lost my train of thought.
Do you feel like we're living more in shadows than we were and when Fred's show was more popular?
More popular
when he was doing it on a daily basis.
It's hard to say. In some respects, yes. I see such a change, as I said, not only in the children but also in the families, but this whole idea of your self-worth really comes through. You can see the children who feel good about themselves. And those are the children that aren't afraid to try things, the children that are willing to be open to other people. And they're the ones that can share. And I think that's the whole idea, is sharing of yourself and, again, being authentic with people. And children respond to that. I think anybody responds to that, people in general, adults too. If you're not being authentic with people, then they just shut down, I think.
Yeah. Beth, do you feel like we're living more in shadows these days?
I suppose so. And as you remarked earlier, and you know, maybe that's why documentaries such as these, you know, are so successful, to see such great successes from people who are championing, you know, the basic dignity for all.
Yeah. Do you feel that way, or is that a little dark from Jeff?
I think actually we're more in the open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I think that that's what I think we're falling victim to. In fact, the writer that wrote for Esquire, I can't remember exactly how he said it, but he said that Mr. Rogers, he wrote this article on him in 1998, and he said that at that moment that Mr. Rogers was losing, that he was losing the battle to the dizzying edit, to the 24/7 news cycle, to the way that life was getting to be so fast and open. I'm not saying, as a journalist, I don't think that things should be kept in shadows, but I do think that with everything, everything, kids and families and adults see everything all the time, that that it's a bit much to keep track of. And I think the idea of being quiet and slowing things down a bit. What I remember most about watching Mr. Rogers is when he won his Lifetime Achievement Award at the Emmys, and he said, take 10 seconds, everybody. What I'd like you to do is and take 10 seconds and think about the person who made you who you are. And then he looks at his watch and he goes, I'll watch the time. And it's a beautiful moment. Like, he's just telling everybody, quiet down for a minute. And I think that's what we're missing.
You're hearing Elisa Orlando, Senior Vice President of Television and News for WXXI, and Paula LaRue Wooters is a teacher in the Rochester City School District's Universal Pre-K program at Asbury Daycare Center, and Beth Cordello is Chair of the Employment Law Practice at Polano & Farrow, and we're talking about Won't You Be My Neighbor and RBG, two documentaries that really did, in terms of the documentary world, boffo box office and captured critical and American attention this summer. even more than a lot of documentaries tend to do. So we're putting those two together, asking you, have you seen them? Do you want to weigh in? It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. As we go to our only break of the hour, Andrew writes to us on Twitter and says, both docs were phenomenal, but Mr. Rogers has a special place in my heart. In a clip, he asks, how do we make goodness attractive? It's a question I can't get out of my mind. He dedicated his life to answering it. If I could accomplish anything in life, it would be to continue that legacy. Something for us all to think about. Short break, and we're coming right back here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, Senator Kamala Harris might run for president, and she is out with a proposal called the Rent Relief Act. She says it will help millions of Americans struggling to pay bills. But some of her critics are coming from the progressive side of the aisle, and they say this will miss the mark. We're going to dig into the policy, and we'll talk about renters and how to help them Wednesday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. In the interest in full inclusion and following the example of Fred Rogers, I will tell you that you can see RBG at the Cinema Theater this weekend. Saturday, there's a matinee, and Sunday as well, at 4:30 on Sunday afternoon. So that's at the cinema, and you have a chance to see RBG. So it's another documentary getting so much attention, and we're not highlighting a film like RBG for any political purposes, despite the fact that inevitably the Supreme Court becomes sort of politicized. But I think just for the human aspect of her work, think about the fact that my numbers, I have, Beth Cordello, tell me if this sounds right to you, 113 people have been appointed and confirmed as justices to the U.S. Supreme Court. Four of 113 have been women, roughly 3.5%.
That's correct. She was the 107th to be appointed, I believe.
Okay, and so she was the second woman in 1993 appointed by President Bill Clinton. Of course, Sandra Day O'Connor, appointed by President Reagan in 1981, was the first. Let's listen to a clip from the film, and this comes from 1978. She was arguing a gender bias case, and in part of the clip, you're going to hear her arguing before the Supreme Court on a gender bias case. You're going to hear the voice of then-Chief William Rehnquist.
Female citizens of Louisiana are denied equal protection by the total absence of their peers from the jury.
I thought the new theory was that there's very little difference between men and women, so why wouldn't a men jury be there?
Well, I'm not aware of that new theory.
They didn't get it. They didn't understand the issues that women were facing, or they didn't see them as issues. Because women had, in their minds, women had a place, and it wasn't where Ruth Ginsburg was suggesting that it ought to be.
Men and women are persons of equal dignity, and they should count equally before the law.
You won't settle for putting Susan B. Anthony on the new dollar.
When they would say things like this, how did you respond?
Well, never in anger, as my mother told me. That would have been self-defeating. Always as an opportunity to teach. I did see myself as kind of a kindergarten teacher in those days because the judges didn't think sex discrimination existed. Well, one of the things I tried to plant in their minds was think about how you would like the world to be for your daughters and granddaughters.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So as the attorney in the room who said you were impacted in your own career by her words, what do you make of the clip that you just heard, not just the context of that single case there, but some of her words there, Beth?
They were inspirational. People should remember, we hear these kind of legal arguments all of the time these days. At the time she was making them, they were the first times we were hearing those arguments, and they were radical at the time. Right. She is in many ways the architect of gender discrimination law in this country.
A lot of your work now tries to kind of work within the framework of what New York State law has said, that we've had you on this program talking about changes to the law and the advancements in equality. And sometimes we ask this question, you know, well, have we achieved what we set out to achieve, as if like there's some sort of a finish line.
Right.
Our friends in the LGBTQ community always laugh and they say, well, the gay agenda's been achieved. I guess we'll all go home now. I mean, like there's an agenda. It's a thing. But how much do you see progress in terms of where Ruth Bader Ginsburg's career started to today, and how much do you still see to go to achieve the equality that she had set out for?
Well, I think back at the time she went to law school, she started at Harvard, I think in the late 1950s, and at that time only 2% of any given law class was female. So I think out of like 500 students, she was one of maybe half a dozen women in her class. And she had a child at the time, and she was on Law Review, I think the first woman to be on Law Review. So it's phenomenal that she was so successful even at law school, given that this was not a place where women were wanted. You know, back in those days in male-dominated fields, women in those spots in the classroom were resented by some because those could have gone to men. So
even the very few women were in those classroom seats, they were resented?
Well, sure, and especially at institutions like Harvard, you know, where every seat is coveted, for them to go to women, and at that time, well, she's ultimately just going to have kids and stay home, right? So why are we bothering? And at that time, when she was in law school, there weren't employment discrimination laws in place, so many law firms didn't hire women for those very reasons.
She said in the film, she became a lawyer, quote, when women were not wanted by the legal profession.
Exactly.
So, you know, it's one thing to say, your seat in a Harvard classroom is coveted. What's the point of you being here? Can't a man take that seat? It's another to say that the legal profession itself didn't want women. Do you agree with that?
Sure. And at the time, that was a perfectly legal position to take. I believe she didn't go into private practice coming out of law school because it was so hard for women to get a job in that position. So she went into academia instead before she began her career as a judge.
And this is where the really recent and powerful conversations that have been roiling, you know, everywhere from what the New York Times labeled the intellectual dark web to other places, it's about whether there are natural gender differences and are we trying to force equal outcomes, which I tend to think is a straw man argument. I think arguing for equal opportunity is not the same as saying there must be equal outcomes.
Right.
But I can envision people who are on different sides of those modern arguments saying, well, are we overstating this? Is it that it's not that the legal profession doesn't want women? Is it just that women naturally don't gravitate toward the law the same way men do? And I know you've heard that before. What do you say when people try to make that argument, Beth?
I think we're hearing that argument, at least I am, less and less. Women now represent about half of the legal profession.
Isn't that interesting?
They aren't... you know, the glass ceiling is still there. You still don't see as many women as, you know, proportionate to those that are practicing as partners in law firms and at the tops of, you know, whichever form they're in the law. And then people will then say the argument, well, that's because they elected to go part-time, to take care of their children. And these are the, you know, the women are most typically the natural and primary caregivers, whether it's for their children or their aging parents and all of this. And while that may be true for some, it's unfair to deny those women who do want to be considered for those positions to not have those opportunities because they're perceived as not being able to handle them for those reasons.
Yeah, that's remarkable. Roughly half the legal field lawyers are women now.
Yes.
But 4 out of 113 justices on the Supreme Court in the history of this country have been women.
And that's a great example.
What did you think of the documentary, Elisa?
I really enjoyed it. I think I actually see similarities between Justice Ginsburg and Fred Rogers. The idea of respecting those who disagree with you, you know, her friendship with Antonin Scalia. Over the years, they had deep respect for each other. They both loved opera, you know, those kinds of things that brought them together. But I thought the film really, for me, illustrated how she lived her values, you know, her entire life. And that to me was really important, but a beautifully made documentary. And it's no wonder she's a rock star now, not just someone to be highly respected.
And Paula, there are planking scenes and exercise scenes.
Yes. Well, good. But I'm not going to be doing those.
We were joking during our brief break that you've admired her just for the exercise regime alone.
Yes.
Huh?
Yeah. She has a little book out on her exercise regimen. And it's totally not doable. very impressed.
She has said she plans to be a justice for at least another 5 years. And the filmmakers told Dahlia Lithwick and Slate that they were especially sorry to see the passing of Antonin Scalia before they could interview him for the film. Because as you mentioned, Elisa Orlando, their friendship was so interesting. They're obviously so different in terms of their legal perspective. Whether you want to take it down to the sort of the, all the way down to the nuts and bolts and the screws of it, to you know, originalist versus, you know, whether the document is a breathing, living document. And they tangled a lot, but apparently they were very close, and the filmmaker said they would have loved to have Scalia in this film. But we still get the sense for the value of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's desire to maintain that friendship, to understand intellectual differences, and that that's a core value for her. Why did you – that's one of the first things you mentioned after this documentary. Why?
I felt from watching the film and not knowing that much about her, I knew something about her. I just came away with a feeling of her deep respect for others, just for other people and for humanity. The other thing I really took away in hearing her voice as much as we did in the documentary, a reminder that she was a dissenter, and what the meaning of a dissenter in our culture today, and especially when it comes to judicial matters, you know, she's one of the great dissenters. The fact that she, you know, when she read and spoke her dissenting opinions, the power of that and the power of those words, what that means for us, and what we can learn from what dissenters do for our culture and for our country, that kind of came home to me just hearing her voice as much as I did.
Beth Cordello, what did you make of the friendship that she shared with Scalia? And now, as a lawyer yourself, mm-hmm. I mean, certainly you've got friends in the legal business that will have different points of view. Do you try to make sure that you're encountering other ideas, other opinions, other viewpoints?
Oh, absolutely. And I admire that about her, and I advocate that, especially in these times when, you know, it's so easy to just look at the news sources that agree with our thoughts and opinions and to just associate ourselves with people who agree with our thoughts and opinions. And it's so easy to shut out opposing views. And I find so much value in having personal conversation and personal relationships with people who don't agree with us and finding common ground, because when you find common ground, then you make change. And, you know, if you can't do that, you can't move forward.
See, that we do have the parallels with Fred Rogers mm-hmm. and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, don't we, Paula?
Yes, because just, again, being able to listen to people, hear what they have to say how you feel, but in a kind, respectful way. Again, whether you're a child or whether you're an adult, it's such a powerful thing to be able to do. And that's what, again, why we work toward teaching the children how to do that.
I'm thinking about dissent. Elisa brings up the idea of dissent, and sometimes when you read the dissents, and Scalia was, whether you liked his sort of viewpoints or generally his opinions or not, a very interesting writer and a mm-hmm. colorful mm-hmm. writer. Yes. Mm-hmm. And Ginsburg has had a lot of really powerful, colorful dissents over the years. As an attorney, do we as a consuming public think, well, the court decided X, and do we forget that there might be a valuable dissent or a voice in a dissent
right.
making a point that we still need to consider, even though the court might have gone against their particular viewpoint?
Right. Those dissents can make a huge difference. A great example of that was the Lilly Ledbetter versus Goodyear, where over the course of, I think, a 20-year career, she was consistently paid less than her male colleagues who were doing the same work. And in her lawsuit, it was dismissed because of statute of limitations issue, meaning that she didn't complain within 180 days or whatever the statute of limitation was in that case. And the Supreme Court agreed with that. Judge Ginsburg wrote a dissent saying this doesn't at all reflect how equal pay issues play out in real life. You know, you don't know with every paycheck necessarily that you're getting paid less. And then you find out you're getting paid less, but you don't know necessarily that it's possibly because you are a female. And you learn these things over time. And this information, you know, employers typically don't share with, you know, wage information with their employees. They're discouraged from discussing it. And so it's unfair to tell Lilly Ledbetter that you should have had this all figured out and your proof all lined up within 180 days. And as a result of that dissent, Congress then went on to pass a law, the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. It was the first law that President Obama signed when he came into office.
All right. So let me read some of the feedback from our audience. Really interesting stuff here that I did not realize that both of these people, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Fred Rogers, are going to be portrayed by actors in the coming year mm-hmm. with a film. So Tom Hanks playing Fred Rogers in You Are My Friend, coming out in the fall of 2019. Scott Pukas reminds us of that. Thank you to our colleague, Scott.
Thank you, Scott.
And Adam Lubitau, who writes on movie criticism for City News, he says, semi-related, with Ruth Bader Ginsburg's story so fresh in people's minds, it'll be interesting to see how audiences react to the more traditional biopic that's getting released later this year with Felicity Jones playing Ginsburg. I did not know that. So I am. There are times where I think I actually miss nothing, and then I realize I miss so much. Where am I? Adam, by the way, says both are great films and also benefit from coming along at a time when people are craving positive, inspiring stories to counteract the deluge of negativity we're getting from the daily news cycle. So, yeah, I mean, Sean Lehman from the DNC says, Won't You Be My Neighbor was a phenomenal portrait of a man who was not afraid to swim against the current and who was unflinchingly passionate about his life's work. How many times have I felt like, I'm just thinking about the way Fred Rogers never felt like he had to be anybody but himself. And if he's going to pull out that Daniel Tiger puppet and talk to another adult with it, he is going to do it. And he's not going to care what that person thinks of him, if he thinks it's the most effective way to talk. How many times have I walked into a room thinking, is my tie straight enough? Do my shoes look cool? I mean, like, Fred Rogers never would have thought of that. And Paula, what's the message to kids when he's teaching them, who you are matters?
Yeah, the same thing. And again, when I'm going into the classroom to work with children, I let them know that I make mistakes all the time. And I don't, like him, I don't use a lot of voices with the children. But to see people who aren't afraid to do that is really, really important for all of us to see that it's what you're saying rather than what you're doing, or not what you're doing. But for example, with the puppets, you can feel comfortable doing that with just about anybody, and not to be embarrassed by it, but just saying, this is who I am. This is really me, and this is what I really think.
There was a moment in the Fred Rogers film where I thought, is this hagiography? I mean, did he do anything? Did he set a foot wrong? And there is a moment where Officer Clement, the gentleman who plays him in real life, recounts a story where Fred Rogers finds out that Francois Clements, is that his name?
Yes.
is gay, and told him, you can't come out. You can't do it. I mean, like, Fred Rogers struggled with that. And then, over time, grew to, you know, love him as the entire person, and there's a really powerful moment in the film about that. So even the one knock on Fred Rogers gets eroded by the end of the film. Jackie writes to us on Twitter and says, RBG was a superhero film I needed this summer. She's done so much for gender equality. I shudder to think about what we do without her and people like her in high courts. I also really enjoyed seeing her relationship with her husband. It's an absolute must see. And she says about Mr. Rogers, that's who we need right now in these times, and it was so refreshing to be reminded of his character. We need more loving, caring, and generous people who will fight for those who can't for themselves. The film moved me to tears. So many tears. A lot of people saying that. So many tears. Suzanne says, I've seen the Fred Rogers documentary twice. Susan says, RBG made me want to go to law school. So just all of these comments about it. And maybe the lesson for us, beyond just the Fred Rogers and the message for kids, but maybe, Elisa, the lesson for those of us who produce television, produce movies, produce documentaries, is positive still sells. You know?
Oh, it
does. I'd like to believe it does.
It does. Positive does still sell. But I also think positive is important. Earnestness and humility are important to people. And I think when you're going to the movies and you're having a shared experience, a group experience where you can say in front of everybody, I love this positivity, I love this humility, I love this earnestness, I love what he's saying, I love what she did, I love the standing up for your values. When you can say that right out loud with a group of people, that feels pretty good. It's pretty human.
Paula, what do you think the legacy of Fred Rogers will be?
I think the kindness, the listening, really hearing what people have to say, really that really sticks with me as a teacher, as a parent, and as a person. Just how important that is, and to do it with grace and with dignity, just like Mr. Rogers did.
Yeah. Beth, RBG's legacy, what do you think? I guess it's still being written.
It's still being written, but certainly one of the great legal champions of equal protection under the law.
Pretty simple. That's pretty easy to put that in a sentence or two. Our thanks to our guests for the hour. Really enjoyed the conversation. As we leave you, we remind you, you can see Won't You Be My Neighbor through Thursday at the Little Theater. And it's an outstanding opportunity to really experience not just what you think you know about Fred Rogers, but who he was, what his family has to say. There's great moments behind the scenes. It's funny. It's really funny. There's one of the guys leading the crew. He was like the funniest guy in the film. There was a lot of funny stuff in there. Elisa Orlando, I'll see you around the building.
Okay.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be here this hour. She's Senior Vice President of Television and News for WXXI. Paula LaRue Wooters, teacher in the Rochester City School District's Universal Pre-K program at Asbury Daycare Center. Thank you so much for sharing your perspective.
Absolutely.
I know your kids are lucky to have you, so thank you. And Beth Cordello from Polano & Ferro in Rochester. Thanks for being back in here. Nice to have you back here.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer, who did a ton of heavy lifting for today's program, as always, as she always does. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great afternoon, and we'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.